It was around 9 p.m. and Pat was in the front seat of her car attending an outdoor movie with her mother in Arcadia, Florida, when something unusual in the twilight attracted her curiosity. It started off looking kind of like an ordinary star in the evening sky, Pat began her fascinating narrative. But as I watched it move across the heavens from north to south over the giant movie screen, I began to realize that the object could not be attributed to any astronomical phenomena, as the bright yellowish light was tumbling toward the Earth in a falling leaf motion. When the object got directly over the car, I couldn't see it anymore, so I got out of the parked automobile and strained my neck looking upward, interested in knowing if it was still visible to the naked eye. At this point, I saw a white light aura shooting out from beneath the object. The best I can describe it is to say it closely resembled a searchlight beacon in that it scanned the ground near where I stood before eventually landing directly upon me. Pat was understandably frightened as the eerie beam was cast down onto her body. Looking up directly into the blinding light, the witness was almost positive that she could make out the bat-like shape of a huge craft hidden behind the brilliant glow that made it difficult for her to see. The light stayed on me for only 3 or 4 seconds, I would estimate. Then it continued to move along the ground as if it was searching for something. Pat says the only sensation she got from being enveloped in the light was a feeling of warmth. For the duration of her experience, Pat's mother was trying to make her get back into the car. She was almost hysterical, near tears. People in the other cars were caught up in the emotion. Someone yelled, "Is it a helicopter?" I knew it wasn't, and my curiosity got the better of me. I just wanted to watch it, so in awe was I of this object. Suddenly the beacon of light flickered out and the object itself got dimmer and dimmer. The yellow glow faded and then went straight up into the air out of view in a matter of a second or two. Pat says she got back into the car, but never got to finish seeing the movie as her mother was too upset and wanted to be taken home. And while Pat's mind whirled with the realization that she had been subjected to a very important experience, her mother refused to discuss their sighting, saying that it continued to frighten her. My mum even had nightmares about this for a long time afterwards. She would dream that they were coming to get her and take her up in the ship or something. In the nightmares, I was always standing outside of the car telling them to come on and land. Being inquisitive, Bait found herself asking a lot of serious questions. I sincerely wanted to know what other people had experienced, if there were others beside myself who had encountered such things. The witness went so far as to keep a notebook in which she jotted down information derived from interviewing local residents who had also observed UFOs. "I gathered some really interesting data," Pat proclaims. "There was this one elderly man who had been sitting on his front porch when he looked up in the early afternoon sky and saw what he initially thought was a jet with sunlight shining off it. He watched the object travel across the sky and then it stopped and moved in closer and came down to within a couple of feet of the ground. He told her he was frightened so bad that he almost had a heart attack. He didn't know how to handle the experience, so he ran inside to call the police, and the highway patrol came to his house right away. On their way to talk to him, one of the patrol cars nearly ran off the road, as this strange craft was sitting practically in the middle of the road." Like others who have had encounters and contacts with UFOs, Patricia yearned to relate her story to someone who would not think she was crazy. Sometime after her bewildering experience, she wrote to a small UFO organization located near her home, and that's when the really puzzling chain of events started happening one right after another. "I met this man on the street in front of our house one afternoon. He said he wanted to talk with me, that he was a reporter who knew what had happened, and was quite interested in UFOs himself. Almost immediately he started talking about all these strange things, UFO propulsion and so forth. He told me he could teach me how to build a UFO and invited me to his house for a demonstration. I thought he was kind of a nut, and I got a genuinely eerie feeling about him, so much so that I even avoided shaking hands with this man. He sort of scared me, and I never found out for sure how he learned of my interest in UFOs. He claimed my mother had run into him one day in the supermarket as she supposedly knew his wife Ewan, and when the subject of flying saucers came up in the course of their conversation, she mentioned my sighting. At the time I didn't think too much about this, as we lived in a rather small town and most people know one another. Pat said she got the impression that the man was evil and meant to freak me out. He went so far as to indicate that she should refrain from talking about what had transpired at the drive-in theater. I got the feeling from him that I should keep my mouth shut from now on. After the man had visited Patricia several times, a truly peculiar thing occurred which continues to alarm her to this day. I was in the backyard when I saw this car driving by. I noticed it was a black car and it slowed down as it passed by the house. The car had tinted windows and so I couldn't see inside. The car went around the corner and I returned to working in the garden when I heard the sound of a car engine being gunned as it came around the block. It was the same car and this time it came to a complete stop at the curb and I could see several faces peering out from behind the darkened glass windows. Staring transfixed at the strange vehicle, Patricia's hypnotic gaze was only broken by the sound of the phone ringing inside the house. I hurried to answer it, anxious to get indoors where I would be safe from whatever was threatening me. I perceived a definite feeling of evil intent about those inside the black car. Lifting the receiver, Pate was startled to hear the voice of the strange man who had come to see her about her sighting. He was screaming, "What are you trying to do to me? Why did you send those men out to run me off the road?" After calming him down, Patricia was able to draw from him the fact that he was out walking when suddenly a car came barreling around the corner, headed directly for him. He had to literally make a dive for the curb, or he would have been struck down and probably killed, since he estimated the automobile was traveling at least 70 miles an hour. As he got up and brushed himself off, he said he was able to see inside the car as it drove off and that there were three men in the vehicle. He claimed they were all Oriental looking. Interested in getting to the bottom of the mystery, Patricia hung up the phone and decided to drive over to the man's house. She had written the address down in her notebook and had actually gone by several times in her car and had noticed him either in the yard or on the porch. There wasn't any doubt that he lived there. However, when I got to the house, it was locked tighter than a drum. The neighbors told her they hadn't seen signs of anyone around the property for a while, though she found this hard to believe since she had just spoken to the man on the phone minutes before. Pat was naturally puzzled by the bizarre sequence of events surrounding the strange black car, as well as the disappearance of the strange man who had frightened her. She wasn't at all familiar with the fact that other individuals who have close encounters with UFOs had also gone through similar experiences. Life goes on. In the years that followed, Pate left home to join the Navy. Upon leaving the service, she moved to Washington, D.C., and got a job working for the FBI as a typist. I want you to understand that I didn't go around talking about my interest in UFOs during working hours, she explained. There weren't that many people who I felt were open-minded enough to relate my experience to. Patricia pointed out that the federal government doesn't have the reputation for hiring cooks, and so she kept her UFO activities pretty much to herself. Late one night, I was already in bed in my small apartment when there was a knock at the door. I got up and cracked the door open only an inch or so, leaving the chain lock in place. The standing in the hall was this Oriental man. At first I didn't think it too strange, because I had an Oriental friend and this man called me by name. But it's what he said next that really shook me up. "Miss Hyde, you will stop investigating flying saucer C/ just looked at him kind of funny and said, "You must be crazy, because I'm not the type of person to be frightened so easily." Next he said something to the effect, "I'm telling you, you will." Pat says she slammed the door in the man's face. I got so mad that I turned around to open the door all the way and yell out at him. However, when I looked up and down the hall, there was nobody there. Pate couldn't see how it was possible for anyone to have disappeared so fast. What was the strange Oriental man dressed in? Well, he had on a suit that was either dark blue or black. She did notice that he had deeply slanting eyes, more so than any other Oriental person she had ever met. Disturbed by the quick disappearance of the midnight specter who bit her personal doom, Pat tossed and turned the rest of the night, finding it impossible to shake the thought of what had transpired from her mind. Unable to get a grip on reality, soon after this incident, Patricia Hyde quit her job with the FBI. The worst was yet to come. I was walking on the street, going back to my apartment one night when this man came up and grabbed my purse. I kind of thought, well, he's going to rob me. He just stood still and dumped the contents of the pocketbook upside down, and when I asked him what he was doing, he said it was none of my business. He searched through everything, throwing my wallet to one side. I knew then he wasn't looking for money, but what was he searching for? Eventually he came across my notebook containing notes on the UFO sightings I had investigated in Florida. I still carried it around with me. Finding this, he ripped the little pad into many pieces. Patricia started to protest, and with this the man identified himself as a police officer. I asked him to show me some identification, and as I stepped forward to defend my rights as an American citizen, he pushed me aside and then backward. As I made a move towards him, I felt someone else grabbing me from behind, and two men took hold of me. With her hands held tightly behind her back, Patricia was unable to take defensive actions against what she was now certain were muggers. I was turned around and pushed toward a van at the side of the road with both the front and side doors open. I began to fight with all my might as I realized they planned to abduct me. I knew they weren't police officers, as they were dressed in dark clothing, and none of them said anything to me, except the first individual who had stated that it was none of my business what he was doing. Dragged into the waiting van, Patricia was handcuffed and driven round the city for a while. With the doors shut tight and the windows of the van blackened over, it was impossible for her to ascertain where the men were taking her. The next thing I knew, it was like 7 hours later. I don't know what happened during that time, and frankly I know we didn't drive round more than 15 minutes. But when we arrived at our final destination, the clock on the wall said 5 a.m., though it should have been only around 9 p.m. Patricia was dragged down a hallway, and two other men told her that she was in a hospital because she had tried to commit suicide by jumping out the window at the FBI building. This I knew was a bold-faced lie, because I hadn't been working there for several weeks and I'd never thought about committing suicide in my entire life. The men took her into an elevator and they came out in an underground passage somewhere. My voice echoed in there, and there were trapdoors in the ceiling. It sort of reminded me of an old armory. When I got to this one room, they wanted me to drink something, and I told them that I wasn't going to do it, and they almost broke my neck making me take this liquid down. They threw me in a tiny room after this and untied my hands, which had been bound from the time they had put me in the back of the van. They wanted me to sign a piece of paper, and when I refused, they left me alone and didn't come back till the next day. Pat woke up the next morning feeling like she had been drugged. There was a small window near the ceiling which was barred, and there was a plant growing up by the window so I couldn't see out to the ground. I went toward the door and it opened when I took hold of the doorknob, so I wasn't locked in. I walked out and there was a man standing in the hallway. I asked him who he was and he said it didn't really matter, and he chuckled and said I was in a psychiatric ward. He explained that my doctor had me committed for trying to commit suicide the night before. I told him I didn't have any doctor, that I was perfectly well and wanted to go home. Eventually, Patricia was brought to the head doctor's office. I don't know if he was a foreigner, but he had light-colored hair and sounded German. He said to me, "I'm your doctor," and when I asked what his name was, he just told me it didn't matter. He knew who I was, my full name, where I had worked. When he told me I had tried to jump out the fifth-story window of the FBI building, I reminded him that all the windows there were barred. With this he looked at me and said, "You will admit that you tried to kill yourself or you'll never leave here." Pat says the doctor asked her all kinds of questions. He wanted to know if I had psychic powers, could talk to the dead, if I believed in flying saucers. Something clinked in my mind, and I just looked at him, refusing to speak. Pat was kept in the same tiny room day after day. She felt she was being brainwashed. They went through the same quiz regularly and tried to convince me that I had tried to kill myself. I kept denying this, and about a week later the doctor put a telephone in front of me and said I could call my mother. Tell her to come and get you. As Pate reached for the receiver, the doctor pulled the phone out of her reach. But only if you promise not to do any more UFO research. Seeing that it was the only way out of this horrifying situation, Patricia told the man she wouldn't mention the subject ever again. I called my mother, told her what was going on, but she didn't believe me. Before allowing me to dial my mum's number, the man had given me an address where he said she could pick me up in Georgetown. I said, "Is this the address of the hospital I'm in?" And he said, "No, that they were going to take me somewhere and drop me off." Patricia's mother took the next plane to Washington, got into a cab at the airport and had the driver take her to the designated address. I had been loaded back into the van and driven around for a while before being taken to the drop-off point. When my mother collected me, she commented, "What is this? It's just a vacant building." We went to the police station, but they weren't able to help us, other than to confirm that no one had been taken into custody for trying to commit suicide or any other crazy thing. Doing the only reasonable thing, Patricia's mother took her daughter home, not wishing to recall the incidents that had happened, perhaps on some netherworld on the astral plane. For where could Patricia Hyde have been taken? Who were the men that had tried to prevent her from speaking about flying saucers? Are they agents of the US government? Not hardly, for they operate in a totally alien manner. Are they the occupants of UFOs, then? Perhaps we will never be able to understand what happened to this young woman, what type of spell she was placed under. Maybe many of the tortures she underwent were implanted in her mind by a power so foreign or so sinister that we had better not get mixed up in the matter. But until we get to the bottom of this mystery, in all probability the men in black will return once again today, tomorrow, in the very near future, and may threaten you or me into silence. Tucson's mysterious case, a strange story brought to our attention back in 1979, indicated that the mysterious and deadly sinister men in black had returned to the western part of the country after a long absence. According to a seemingly sincere Tucson, Arizona newsboy, Warren Wiseman, he was delivering the Arizona Daily Star on February 19, 1979. Between 5 o'clock and 6 a.m. when he saw an odd-looking object crash into a parked car at the side of the road. This is the youth's story. I was on Winstall Boulevard when I saw this falling star come from the sky. It was traveling at great speed and landed about a block away. It smashed the back of a white Volkswagen, throwing off its right rear wheel, rolled off the car and knocked over a mailbox on a post nearby. The 10-year-old fifth grader said the object was about the size of a microwave oven, was black, shiny, and had lots of lava-like holes all around it. Wiseman said the object was smoking when he walked over to it. As he bent over to examine his unusual find, a brown car pulled up and, says the witness, a skinny man in a brown suit and white shirt got out of the car. He was an FBI type. He told me, "Why don't you go ahead and deliver the rest of your papers?" As he stood talking to the man, what Warren thinks was a Pima County Sheriff's car pulled up alongside the brown car. "I was afraid that the man in the brown suit was going to pull a gun," Warren said. He quickly departed for home to tell his mother about what had happened. 20 minutes later, he returned to the scene of the crash with his mother. "All we found was the tire and the broken mailbox. The smashed car and the smoking object had totally vanished without a trace." Interviewed later, the boy claimed he had put a small chip from the object into his pocket while looking it over. However, when he got home a little while later, it was gone. "I don't know what happened to it," he confessed. "I didn't have any holes in my pocket from which it could have fallen to the ground." What at first might seem to be a tall tale fabricated by a highly imaginative youth has additional verification in that there were other witnesses to the event. The Arizona Daily Star says that three counselors who patrol the area while children deliver newspapers saw it fall but didn't see where it hit the ground. The woman who lives in the house where the mailbox was knocked down said she and her family assumed someone had hit it with a car. Margaret Pierce said she hadn't heard anything unusual that morning, but around the time Warren usually delivers the paper to their house, our dogs just started barking and we couldn't calm them down. They were really upset, and that's not like them at all. Shortly after the incident was reported, the then active National UFO Organization, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, got involved in the investigation and tried its best to get to the bottom of what actually happened. Other witnesses who might have seen the object crash were sought. Though final evidence never came forth, Warren Wiseman, just like so many others, became one frightened individual, due to a possible visit by a MIB. Abduction and MIB incident in Canada. Another weird account of MIB activity comes our way from Lawrence J. Fenwick and Joseph Muscat, co-directors of the Canadian UFO Research Network, QFORN. Two different cases involving the abduction of humans by UFO entities in Canada occurred pretty much around the same time in August, 1979. The people abducted were a girl of 14 and a man of about 43 years of age. The girl was aboard for 15 minutes, the man for an unknown length of time. The incidents were investigated by Canada's then largest UFO investigation group, the Canadian UFO Research Network, or QFORN. The evidence included matted down grass, residual radiation, physical effects on one abductee, an MIB visit, and an independent observer who saw the UFO moving to the spot where the girl's abduction took place. To this day, the independent observer, a woman, does not know that there was an abduction involved. The first of a series of UFO sightings which culminated in the abductions happened in the eastern part of Toronto, Ontario, on Thursday night, August 2nd. That same night, 1 hour later, similarly shaped UFOs were reported in northwestern Kansas and southwestern Nebraska, 1,150 miles southwest of Toronto. Articles about the sightings in the Norton, Kansas Telegram and the McCook, Nebraska Gazette were sent to QFORN headquarters by Edmonton, Alberta member John Musgrave. He sent them as part of his monthly UFO clipping service. QFORN, founded in December 1977, is a group with 55 members in 5 countries. Its membership is restricted to persons with expertise in dozens of scientific fields. QFORN's policy is to avoid contacting the media which distorts, ridicules, fabricates and exploits UFO events, especially in major cities. This leads to crank phone calls and harassment of UFO observers. In order to avoid this, the names of 3 girls and one of their mothers have been changed in this article. The 3 girls are Sarah Hines, 14, Kathy R., 14, and Jackie B., 11. They and Jackie's mother filled out the appropriate QFORN sighting report forms, CE2s and one CE3 form. The incidents involved 7 teenagers, 13 parents and one young boy. They saw 6 UFOs, 2 of them arrowhead in shape. At 9:50 p.m., August 2nd, Sarah saw something in the sky nearby and told her 2 girlfriends to follow her to the field nearby, which is owned by Ontario Hydro. 2 lights were hovering low near high-tension power lines. The 2 objects rose when they arrived, one heading south, the other north. From his house window, Kathy's father saw one of the objects at 9:50 p.m. He later refused to fill out a sighting report form. When the 2 objects had left, Kathy sighted 2 arrowhead-shaped objects, which appeared to be moving backwards from the northwest at 9:52 p.m. A minute later, Sarah and Jackie observed a cigar-shaped object. It was black with white lights around the periphery and a green light at one end. The cigar was following an arrowhead-shaped UFO at about 500 feet elevation. The cigar emitted a sound like a generator operating at low power. An oval-shaped object appeared at 9:55 p.m. It had a green haze around it and had 4 curved legs longer than the body of the object. There was a dull red light on top, red lights along the bottom and yellow lights around the circumference. It appeared to hover over the senior public school roof, 2 blocks northwest of Sarah's home. This object was 12-15 feet in diameter and about 6 feet in height, excluding the legs. Another girl, Jody, saw the object over the roof. When she approached the wall of the school, she felt paralyzed and began to cry. The 7 teenagers on the school grounds were soon joined by their parents. The parents said they did not see the oval object, only the arrowhead and cigar objects. The teenagers said the crickets in the vicinity stopped chirping during the incident. The oval object lifted off the roof about 30 feet, hovered again and then disappeared from sight when its lights went out at 10:05 p.m. Immediately, the sound of the crickets was heard again. Sarah normally sleeps 4 to 5 hours a night, but this night she slept 12 hours with no dreams. On Friday the 3rd at 9:50 p.m., the same observers plus Kathy's mother, a friend, Bill McMillan and Jackie's brother, Ernie, went to the field, which is adjacent and to the east of the school grounds. Again, the sounds of life in the field seemed to stop. No cars were seen or heard on the normally busy street, which led to Buttonville Airport, 3 miles to the north. They saw an oval object the size of a football field at a 300-foot elevation. It was flat, dark and solid appearing, with large checkered patterns and 3 large fans of 50-foot diameter beneath. The entire object turned over slowly, rose and headed south very slowly. At 10 p.m., Bill and Ernie observed 2 large arrowhead objects at about a 500-foot elevation north of the field. The angle of elevation to the observers was 50 degrees. One object seemed to explode silently. The pieces separated as if a jigsaw puzzle was being taken apart. The object's total size was now doubled by the separation of the pieces. This object and the intact object were now separated by 200 feet. Sarah had an urge to go alone to another field 3/4 miles northeast of the hydro field. Sarah walked, as if in a trance, to the other field. There she saw 4 bright lights hovering at about 500 feet elevation at 10:10 p.m. Sarah returned home and again slept 12 hours with no recall of dreams. At 10:30 p.m. that night, Kathy dialed the telephone operator and asked her whom to call to report a UFO sighting. The operator suggested she call the Ontario Provincial Police. She spoke to David Craig, an OPP public relations officer. He called an acquaintance of his who knew Joe Muscat, Q-Form co-director and president. Muscat phoned Sarah on the 5th. That night he visited and interviewed Sarah and her mother Alice, after notifying co-director and secretary Lawrence J. Fenwick. Events began once more at 9:50 p.m. on Saturday, August 4th. The same teenagers, along with Jackie's father, went to the hydro field. Jackie's mother, at this time, was walking a few blocks away and saw an arrowhead object heading north at about 20 miles an hour about 2 feet above the street level. Just after her observation, the people in the field watched 2 hovering arrowhead objects for about 2 minutes. Then, at 500 foot elevation, the objects all headed eastward like a flash. Also at 9:50 p.m., Sarah felt compelled to walk away from her friends to the field northeast of the hydro field. All sounds of life seemed to stop. Sarah crossed the road to the field without looking for cars. She said she had the feeling that there would be no cars and there were none. There usually is some traffic on the street even late at night, since it is a main north-south street. Upon reaching the field at 10:05 p.m., she saw an arrowhead object move off the street to the field and in front of her. It settled slowly to a height of 2 to 3 feet above the foot-high grass. She walked to within 2 feet of the object. Suddenly she saw 4 shadow-like figures emerge from the object and hover in a semicircle 2 feet above the ground. The figures were 4 feet tall, football-shaped, 1.5 feet wide and less than 1 inch thick, like wafers. She looked at them for 1 to 2 minutes and passed out. She recalled being on the UFO and observing the general area. She also saw a man in a blue suit walking a dog. She remembers waking up in the field 15 minutes later at 10:20 p.m., stretched out on the ground about 15 feet south of where the object had been. Again, Upon her return home, she slept 12 dreamless hours. Muscat asked her why her face was orange red. She said, "You won't believe this." He asked her if she had any other marks on her body. She said yes. She showed Muscat her right hand.